Hello and welcome to the Lakeshore Records podcast On Cue With. I'm your host, Alon Levitin, and for today's episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Emmy Award nominated composer Ariel Marks. If you're an artist or creator of any sort, you should be hanging on Ariel's every word. She's a one-of-a-kind avant-garde risk-taker with a knack for pushing boundaries and getting under our collective skin in the best way possible. We covered a lot of ground in our discussion, including breakdowns of her brilliant approach to the scores for Sanctuary, Shiva Baby, and A Small Light, the importance of perpetual contrast in music, Ravel's string quartet, Judaism's deep cuts, the Alliance for Women Film Composers, the hidden dangers of the word compromise, and so much more. I highly recommend you go down your own private Ariel Marks rabbit hole and make her music part of your essential playlist. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Ariel Marks as much as I did.
I'm very excited to speak with you. I've been blasting your Sanctuary score. I feel like you're currently on fire in the best way possible.
Thank you.
And before we jump into the specifics of the scores, which I'm very excited to talk about, how are you? What are you up to these days?
I'm good. I've been doing a lot of promotional work for A Small Light. It's been great. They've been inviting us to a lot of panels and events, like the one last night, which was great. And you know, like just enjoying the release of the album of Sanctuary too. Have a couple docuseries I'm working on, true crime, and but just like taking a little bit of a breather because it's been like 18 months of really intense project after project. So this is a little bit of a slower period. It feels like I don't want it for very long, but it feels very good to have it right now.
Well, it's good for creativity, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. It is like, yeah, I'm done romanticizing the starving artist grind, you know, like it really doesn't make us better musicians to work 24 hours a day. It makes us better musicians to rest and have things outside of music to feed us. So
yeah, better humans too.
Exactly.
So backing up, can you give us a little bit of your background? What got music into you?
So I had always, played music since I was a little kid. I went to a Waldorf school and we played music in our classes. Like I started on recorder, but then we had a youth orchestra and I played flute and then I transitioned into guitar and piano and then settled on violin as my love. But you know, my mom and dad can both sing and play instruments really beautifully. And I just grew up around a lot of that. My dad, he sings in temple nearly every weekend. And so he used to do it a lot more. He's doing it once a month now. But he's always, there's always been a lot of music in that regard. And I come from a line of, I think he said 7 cantors in our lineage. So like, there's a lot of musical genetics, not that that is necessarily a thing, but it's in my history. And then for film scoring, like I just realized I enjoyed writing music more in a collaborative way and not necessarily in like a, I really loved working with other mediums. So storytelling with, I started before I even knew I wanted to do this, I would like, you know, create a piece of art and then write music for it. Cause I just loved the multimedia aspect of it. And then it took a friend in college and undergrad to say like, hey, this actually sounds like film music. And I was like, oh yeah.
Can I ask, when you say you would create a piece of art and then make music to it, can you break that down? What do you mean exactly?
So I was like starving for anything to do. I would create shadow boxes. Do you know what those are?
No.
Those are like 4-inch deep frames and so you can create depth in them. So you can create, like a 3D piece of art. What I would do is create these scenarios where it was basically like a frozen in time animation. So I would have like 4, like screenshots of a story. And, I would like my mom is also a painter. So I grew up like doing drawing and painting with her all the time. And so I would paint characters, make paper mache stuff, like buy moss from Michaels and make trees and like all of these. So I just create these little like four section stories and then write a piece of music for it.
So your father was a cantor, which can you just upon so for people that don't know?
Sure. So he's not, I come from a line of cantors. He's not a cantor, but he plays guitar and sings during services. So he didn't go to school for it, but he, like right now he plays once a month at, both a Reform and Conservative synagogue. So he does the music for all the prayers, and along with a cantor. So he's really doing the background and kind of supportive vocals.
And your mother is a painter, did you say?
Yeah, she's a multimedia artist now. I mean, she's moved on to like more mixed media sewing and embroidery and mixed with paints and stuff. She actually just had her first solo show. But yes, so she was a graphic designer by trade.
The reason I'm doing such a deep dive into your backstory is just, I find you to be just so inspiring. Your music is so artistically driven and full of life and refreshing. You know, I feel that you take risks and you have a deep, deep, deep sense of art and artistry, and you're able to articulate it very well. So now it's kind of making a little bit more sense to me. You grew up with this sort of environment around you. And I'd love to know if there were conversations about art, about music, what it is, what its function is, mm-hmm. general approach.
In my family?
Yeah.
I think, I can remember as a kid, my dad was always playing guitar. I mean, I have like some of my favorite pictures of him are in, he was in something called the 39 string band, and they counted all the strings on their, the banjo being the five string odd one. But he was just always playing music and always singing. And my mom is, you know, she played piano. She has a beautiful voice. Both of my parents can harmonize immediately. When they're just singing. So every time we sang, like folk music or Christmas music or Jewish music or any, you know, it was always very embellished and lovely. And in terms of like a deep, deep conversations about music, I wouldn't say it was like scholarly conversations around the dinner table, but I will say they really supported me going to like pursuing music. And we, like my sister is a circus performer. And so she's an aerialist and she hangs from the ceiling and so is her husband and she's amazing. And so they kind of, we all were like entrepreneurs in our own way. So it was not, they just supported it. It wasn't a crazy decision for me to go to music school or pursue it.
That's amazing. You too are technically an aerialist, right? Did you, when you had this aha moment, someone said to you, this sounds like film music. What did you do with that information?
So I was in this area. I had graduated undergrad and I'd been playing music all up to this point, but not taking it seriously in terms of it, you know, being able to make money, and have it as a lifestyle. And I was just, I had graduated undergrad. I got my, degree in plant biology and ethnomusicology. So the study, like the anthropological study of music, and I studied American string music, folk music, as my focus. And I was in like a jazz combo and I was in a contra dance band playing folk music. I was doing like all these different things and I didn't know where I was going next or what I was doing. And as soon as he said that, it was like I was waiting for permission from someone, and not like film music is any one thing, but what he meant by that was that like I hear the narrative behind it. So then I worked my tail off, I think, for the next 3 years and studied private compositions lessons with a professor in Massachusetts and just got my chops up. And I decided to apply to NYU for their screen scoring program. And I went there. And then that education was amazing. Not only technically, but also just being in New York and meeting all of the filmmakers that I met there, that I can trace every single project to, you know, a few short films I did 10 years ago.
So in terms of your composition study, what are some of the main salient takeaways from that?
Yeah. Felipe Salas was my first, and then, Peter Rowe. So I studied with both of them. Peter Rowe actually plays he plays the sitar, and he teaches at NEC. And Felipe is an amazing saxophonist. And so that was very much jazz language. And Peter was a bit more about just developing my own voice as an instrumentalist. And at the time I was maybe considering pursuing more of a performance thing rather than a compositional degree. It just became clear that I loved so much more the creation of it, and not that, I just love the collaborative aspect of it and the multimedia aspect of it. And you know, I would say in school, I learned we all have our favorite composers that we can score study anytime we want. And those resources are free on the online, you know, but what school was so valuable was that I got exposed to so many industry professionals and also learned all of the technical things that I had to, like how to run all of the programs that I have to run to do this, mixing, music editing, producing a recording session, music copying, you know, like all this. When you're a beginning fledgling film composer, you really do have to do everything. You don't have the resources to just ship it out and hire an orchestrator and hire a engineer. So you really have to know how to do it all. And that was amazing exposure. And then I just did a zillion short films and met so many wonderful filmmakers that have gone on to do great things that have led me to this very moment.
And at what point do you feel like you have a grasp on the job? Doing short films, I'm sure it's, you know, trial by fire. Mm-hmm. Is there a certain point where you feel like you got your rhythm, you got your stride?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I've learned is that every challenge, once you get over it and do it once, it's never scary again. And I got, like, what I learned in the very early days was the value and the skill of communication. Like, you can be as talented as ever, but if you are not a good communicator and you're not a good collaborator, it's not going to work out. You know, you need it. Like, it's a conversation with your collaborators and the director and the producers and the story itself. And you have one vote in it, but there are so many other people with opinions about it, and how to be kind of gracious with that. And also to be open to, yeah, actually maybe that idea or that approach is better than what I thought would be the right fit. So just those early, doing so many short films really taught me a way of navigating a lot of different dynamics and scenarios and like my best friends are the filmmakers that I worked with at that time. So it was great. And then, you know, as I got into more high profile projects, like the first higher profile project I did was called The Tale, that we met. Mm-hmm. And that was my like first feature and like big feature. And that, of course, as we all probably do on our big projects, like suffer from imposter syndrome. But I was ready. I was ready for it. And I knew I was ready for it and I could do it. And I was so thrilled that they were taking a chance on me. And once I got, you know, once I got through that experience, nothing seemed as scary. It's just, you keep, okay, the next one, next one, next one. And you start getting more confident in yourself. And at this point, like more recently, episodic TV has been a newer thing for me. And in terms of working on something that has 9 episodes versus a 2-hour film. And once you do it, then you understand. I mean, and it was also, I also really love in longer form, like you get 9 hours to explore your thematic material rather than 2. And so it's a very different approach and the way you have enough time to really flesh out your musical ideas. And you don't kind of make, I pulled out the stops on in the Sanctuary score very early on, like it got bombastic and crazy really early. And that's what you can do in a film. But if, you know, oftentimes you want to build a little bit more slowly in a television series. So those are just 2 totally different skills, but I feel just so grateful. I'm just like the recent projects I've done, everyone's kind of let me be me. I haven't had to compromise or write, you know, try to like be another composer because they couldn't hire that composer. You know, they really hired me for me. And that was, I'm very, very lucky about that.
How do you communicate, generally speaking, what it is that you do? Do you have a general mission statement or an ethos?
I've never thought about that in terms of reducing it into a couple sentences. I'm going to try my best not to sound corny, but my favorite way to be involved in film and TV is to have the music highlight something and be the underbelly of the story that isn't shown on screen. So I can add a different dimension to how you perceive something. It's really just another actor in what you're making. And just as much as the cinematography is an actor and the production design, and it's like all of these elements are so important, and they're not as glitzy and you know, they aren't as showcased as acting or directing, but like these tiny little details are really what make things feel, you know, what they are. So I'm just one of those.
You're a storyteller.
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone is. Yeah. Involved.
And sound is a key element of telling that story. And what I find so interesting about telling stories in sound is that, just like acting, just like everything else that you mentioned, but sound, I feel in particular, and music in particular, can, my blue is not your blue.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, 2 people can see and hear the same thing and just have completely different emotional interpretations of that.
Totally.
And that I find music to be so fascinating in that its job tends to be to narrow that field. Mm-hmm. So that it can, you know, telegraph a little bit more of the story.
Mm-hmm.
But I find what you do to be particularly intriguing, and it's part of why I asked you such a mean question, is that you add this sort of, and you correct me if my language is off, but avant-garde sort of experimentation to everything, I feel. And I would think that would be challenging in commercial projects, but somehow you pull it off. Thoughts?
That's huge, huge compliment. Thank you. I think you're right. And we don't all see the same colors. And especially in music, like you could hate something that I love. And that often happens. And that's kind of what's humbled me about collaboration, is like and also audience and viewership and appeal to the general public is, like, I've been involved in projects where, of course, that's important, but it's also like the ethos has been, we're doing our own thing. Not everyone's going to love it. We're taking a big swing, and like stylistically, and like, let's commit to that and not try to be everything and not try to please everyone. So I mean, it's interesting. So the film that I think gave me a bit of permission for every future project was Shiva Baby. So that film, like Emma, and Emma is an NYU connection. Emma was so lovely and generous and amazing and you know, unique. And the scenario is basically like, just throw whatever you want at it and we'll react to it. And like, no, crazier, sparser, no melody, like all texture, all anxiety, you know? And that was like, I've never gotten to write a score like that, though I love, obviously, like that's what I love to do. It was an amazing like improvisation with myself. And I think that it was like totally unexpected that the score kind of got a life of its own along with the film. And I think that gave me then I got hired based on that. So I got Candy based on that. And then Candy was its own way of, you know, obviously a Shiva baby palette wasn't going to work, but it was like, please bring that level of unexpectedness to this score. And then that led to a friend of the family, and a friend of the family was its own way of doing that. And then all of this led to A Small Light, and Shiva Baby also led to Sanctuary. And so it's, so in terms of palette, like I try very hard to not use the same samples or the same instruments in the same ways in every score. Like I really try to, I mean, obviously strings are strings, woodwinds are woodwinds, you know, there's only so much you can do. But like with Sanctuary, there are definitely Shiva Baby-esque palettes to it because he had really liked the kind of punctuation of that. But it was very much more a jazz, a free jazz improvisation palette. So there was a lot more. I worked with an amazing woodwind player. His name's Josh Plotner, and he does my woodwinds for everything. And we just did an enormous Barry Sachs sampling session. And then I also did a 4-hour percussion sampling session with the same percussionist that worked on Shiva Baby. And I did those even before I started writing. So I had this arsenal of sounds that then I wove throughout, because you just can't get away with a score like Sanctuary. You can't mock something like that up and then say, oh, and you also can't just create a vague palette and just say, no, don't worry, it's going to be crazier. Like you really have to show what you want to do. And I think I've, even before it's approved, and yet, you know, you have to take I've learned to take kind of financial and artistic risks before to show exactly what I'm going for, because it's hard to articulate it if you're trying to do it after the fact.
It's a level of confidence and commitment to yourself and to your vision and to just execute it at all costs. I think that's a great tip.
I mean, it's confidence for sure, but it's also like you have to be prepared to, they may not like it, and then, okay, like that's like one less sample library I'll buy next month to make up for it or whatever, you know, but it's not, I have to say, you cannot take the risks you want to unless you show what you want to do. So it's, you know, and like what I love so much about White Lotus and the success of that soundtrack has been it's so beloved, and it's made a more experimental, quirkier, out there approach more commercially tasteful in a way. And so I think there's a lot more openness to kind of non-traditional music.
Yeah,
that's one example of one, but I love that score, and I love what it did for our community too.
Agreed. You mentioned Shiva Baby, which when you sent it to me, you used the word anxiogenic, and which I had never heard before. And I thought, I just thank you for educating me on that. And it was as you said, freeing for me to just, oh, there can be an anxiogenic score through and through. Which, can you explain that word? And just,
yes. So I didn't know what it was either until a reviewer used it about the music, and then I read it and I was like, you know, this is a beautifully poetic way of saying this is induces anxiety. There was another favorite quote, which was, it was like a music for a dinner party for an ulcer. There was like a lot of like basically mostly compliments, but also like, yikes, what, you know, you made me go through hell and back. So yeah, that was really, and I was like highly stressed, but in a very fun way making that as well. I mean, it's hard to write that kind of music without it like elevating your own anxiety, but yeah, in a good way.
Yeah, and I think you have this extremely unique talent to, you know, I think of The Tale, I think of Candy, I think of all these things that you're mentioning, Shiva Baby, Sanctuary. It really pushes you to the edge, right? These projects, and they can, on paper, I could see how this could be a train wreck, right? Mm-hmm. If not handled properly, mm-hmm. in the wrong direction, and music is such a key factor to get it tonally correct.
Right.
And I think that you're like this ace in the hole that's able to navigate our anxieties and this very complicated character driven stories in such a fluid manner. And Sanctuary in particular, is part of the reason that we're talking today, because it just came out. I was just, I couldn't handle it at moment. And I love it for that. I'm very curious what the conversations about this movie were like.
Yeah. I mean, so some of my favorite, like one of my favorite, it's been said in a couple of different ways, but that this was the craziest episode of Succession ever. Yeah. But it's, you know, it's all about power. So it's like, it's these two, it's a two-person film and one location, and it's basically in real time. And like, sound familiar? A lot like Shiva Baby. And but this one is much more of a, like a genre bending dance between people with a lot of emotional baggage and a lot of dysfunctional tendencies in intimacy. And so this movie, I mean, should I give the log line for it? Essentially, a wealthy to be CEO is having his last meeting with his dominatrix, and he tells her that he's not going to be needing her services anymore. And she loses it and tries to turn the tables and make herself invaluable to him. So it's really just like a tug of war the entire film. And that was with Zach. I mean, Zach, the director, it was very much about like knowing who has the power in the scene and what is the level of threat / genuineness. In the beginning of the film, you know, there's a little bit more flirtation and funniness and out of, you know, there's a little bit more humor to it. And as you get into the middle, becomes a bit more threat and like consequence. And it's all about kind of playing, the music was about playing with levels of playing with your expectations, but also playing with, is this a script or is this dialogue? There's a script within a script in the film. So is this a role play or are they being genuine with each other? Is this love? Is this anger? Is this psychosis? Is this a fake psychotic break, you know? So it's all about, the music was very much about trying to tease at these different things.
Was it clear that there would be a swing / jazz element to it from the beginning?
Yeah. And that was, you know, that the one piece of diegetic music that is in is like right after the session, you know, they're listening to jazz while they eat their steak and kind of have the, you know, the discussion about what they liked and didn't like about it. And so, I mean, it's in a hotel, swanky hotel in New York, you know, it has that, but it was sort of disemboweling that genre. And so, I mean, that is kind of what I did with Shiva Baby too, is like take a like klezmer-esque elements and like eviscerate them. And that was sort of what a similar approach in for Sanctuary, except with jazzier elements.
Yeah, which is very interesting because there's in jazz, there's such an interplay between the instruments, right? And you have, it's similar with the characters. There's such a back and forth and dialogue amongst them. And I think that the actors, the entire film was really a cinematic achievement, the music as well. Like, I just really was very, very impressed at how much it got under my skin. And then also, without, no spoilers, but also delivered. It delivers.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it, I think this is not a spoiler. I think it culminates perfectly, absolutely perfectly at the end. And there is a track in particular that I was just so overjoyed to hear from you. She's in Charge Now. I feel that that is a literally a perfect song, which is incredibly rare. I am such a bastard. I am,
and you're like, so incorrect, but thank you.
Well, please, please school me, because I just, I find it to be like the melodies, the harmonies, counter melodies, the entire structure of the song. Like, no, I mean, it's not the right thing to say with music, but no notes.
That's, you're so kind. It's,
I really, really would love for you to give me a back, the backstory of that track in particular, and get sure. nerdy, like really nerdy and break down that track. And how you came to it.
It's one of my favorite pieces too, which is why it's the first one on the album. And I, you know, I don't get to, I'm not usually the one people call for like these more old school, sweeping, swooning aesthetics, old Hollywood aesthetics. But I mean, I can do it, but I don't, like, it's not what I'm known for. And this was a great opportunity to have there's a cinematic moment in at the end of this film that really calls for this. And so I really got to show that I could do this and explore in this palette in the way that Succession and that brilliant score takes it's like, it's all about a feeling of self-importance. It was very much of this feeling of like, they believe that they are in a grander, healthier, more successful love story than they're actually in. Like, it's actually devastating to hear this piece of music over that in some ways. Cause it's like, you guys are so fucking doomed, you know? And so it was like wanting to play up, like, that was not the time for subtlety. The biggest note, the biggest word that Zach gave me was, we just need to swoon. It needs to swoon, swoon, swoon. It's very melodic. It's very constant. Like, there's not a lot of tension in the music. It's very slick, but as slick as I like. Like, I tried not to pour too much sugar on it, but it is very, very, very sweet. So it starts off with this kind of cascading, building string introduction that then leads to the title of the film and the credits. And then it reduces to a string quartet, and Josh Plotner again on flute, oboe, clarinet. He's overdubbing all of these really, like, you know, very slick and ornamented and expressive melody lines and counterpoint. And then we also used a 40-piece string orchestra from Macedonia. But the string quartet and the string orchestra are, those were recorded with Thames in Macedonia, which I worked with a lot.
So, how did you write it? Right?
Go ahead.
So here's part of why, I mean, I love it in and of itself. Had I heard it just out in the ether, I would just love it. But coming from you in particular, right? As you said, I'm just so impressed because, you know, here we are 5 minutes ago talking about anxiogenic scores that are, you know, essentially to my ear, to a degree, exposing us to the outer elements of instrumental capability, right? Like where does the instrument sort of fail?
Mm-hmm.
this is the exact opposite of the spectrum. This is how beautiful can you make these instruments sing together? And I think it's so impressive that both things can come from one person. And so I really want to understand, literally, How did you write it? Like, what was the process?
Very much by ear. Music theory is very, very, in a way, very mathematical. It's like vegetables or like vitamins for me, trying to, you know, using it. And so I use it when I need to. But with this one, it was all by ear. I started off with the melody, the da 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 da. There's a lot of leading tones, lots of leaning tones swooning into each phrase. It's very wandering. I mean, one of my favorite parts is the opening and the closing, and just building in those beautiful, you know, crescendos that strings and woodwinds can do. And honestly, the way I write, like, I have a very simple harmonic idea in mind, and then I just experiment with different, more tension colors over it. And I don't mean tension colors, but like not only using 1, 3, 5, 7, you know, in chords, like making sure that I'm creating that kind of gorgeous dissonance that makes something more emotionally complex than a major chord. And or a major 7 chord, or, you know, and obviously jazz in itself is more like, I remember studying jazz harmony and jazz music theory, and that is like a whole, it's like, you know, a crazy calculus of its own. But it was definitely helpful in terms of like finding different harmonic choices I could make that are a little bit different than had I been, you know, in a different genre. The way I write is just, you have something, you have a single line, and then I try, and then I layer and add on top of it. It's not on, a lot of it is not pre-planned and mapped out and written. Like, so much of it is by reacting with how I hear. And that's how I find I come to some of my most happy accidents when that happens, you know? So I try to, like, music theory is there when you need it, but I feel like it makes me make safe choices sometimes. And so
it's so tasteful, right? I find it to be incredibly tasteful, which is, I think, is challenging. Mm-hmm. Because there's a sort of economy of notes, and with the arrangement is very swoon worthy, and it gives you exactly as much as you want of each little line as it moves forward, as it progresses. And I'm wondering if there was editing involved to land there, or was it, you know, bit by bit, like, was there too much in there? And then did you have to pull it out?
Yeah. So I always overwrite. And then one of my favorite things to do is edit and peel things back, because that's often how I write. Like, I'll throw everything I have at something and then take a break and come back and then try to see, okay, I don't, like, especially when you're working in minimalism and just textures and, you know, like, everything holds so much weight. So editing becomes like another necessary step of composition. And I find it just as important. So yeah, I do, like, one of my favorite things to do is to pass lines between instruments and hear things on one instrument and then hear it in another, hear it in one register, hear it in a lower register, have an instrument not just be limited to melody, but then also they also serve as more of a rhythmic element and or more of a textural element in the same piece. And, you know, so not kind of making sure people never get really bored with their parts. And like the concert you came to last night, that was like very much a goal of writing for that small ensemble. It was a 4-person band and ensemble. And it's, how do I keep the movement and these textures. So not the cello isn't always playing the low notes and the rhythm. The violin isn't always playing the melody. The clarinet isn't always playing the melody. You know, how do you make sure that these, even in small ensembles, these roles get switched off? And that's what I think, like, the best orchestrators do. Like, one of my, I'm sort of veering off topic, but.
No, you're right on.
It was like a little bit, one of my favorite pieces that I always go back to is Ravel's string quartet. And I am in love with and find that absolute perfection in terms of, it's like a tour de force of each string instrument. And it requires so much virtuosity of each player. And so I think, like when I was in school, I studied that piece a lot. And yeah, so I think that has always inspired me to keep things moving and changing in terms of roles. So that's like, so the piece starts like very orchestral. It goes into woodwinds and like very light string accompaniment, and then light string quartet accompaniment. And then the violin starts doubling the clarinet line. And then there's more of a counter melody with the second violinist. And then the woodwinds drop out and it's just a string quartet taking that, and there's no percussion, there's no bass. It was just the string quartet doing that. And the string quartet has such a different feeling than, you know, like a whimsical oboe or clarinet. And they really like, you know, make it much more serious and swooning, and then bringing back the full orchestral forces or full string orchestra forces for the end. So I guess the word in music school that I was like always found helps, and it's like a keyword whenever I'm feeling stuck, is contrast. Like always look for contrast.
And then is it just a question of taste, personal taste?
I think some people would have written this very differently, and it like in terms of not being as, I think I can't sit still in one thing for long. And I mean, I can and I can't, but I make choices to switch things up quite often. And I think some that might drive some people crazy, and you know, some people might enjoy sitting longer in certain aesthetics or sitting longer in, it's just up to personal taste. And that's wild in this industry to say like, God, like how do my personal taste has to match with your personal taste. And if it doesn't, we have to find out what the difference is in words that we understand. And it still has to serve the story. And it's like, it's crazy mind reading. It's amazing. I mean, it's wonderful, but it's like, I don't know how we ever please each other plus an audience. It's everyone has such different opinions, you know?
It's like the highest common denominator, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It might, you know, again, I think we touched upon this earlier. You and I might love something, but not for the same reasons.
Yeah.
I don't, like in Sanctuary in particular, I kind of loved hating the male character. I just couldn't stomach him. And he was so, the actor.
Christopher Abbott.
Yeah. Both of them absolutely crushed it. And yeah. I just was like, come on, man. I just couldn't.
I know.
but I found myself greatly enjoying, it was almost like hate watching him.
Yeah.
Something.
Yeah.
Getting his comeuppance to a certain degree, but then it's very dysfunctional, as you mentioned, no spoilers. I could envision somebody having a different experience of that character.
Right.
Empathizing with them. And I think it's really interesting to see how the music, your music in particular, can allow that space for multiple interpretations of something so multi-layered.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the privilege I have working on the projects that I have, is that the stories are so strong, the style is so strong, that the music is only additive. Like I'm not trying to fix an emotion, a scene that doesn't have enough emotion in it, and they want me to create the emotion. Like there's already the story and performances are self-sufficient on their own, and so then music gets to be the chaotic, you know, the voice of chaos in terms of really kind of tilting it one way or another.
I should probably formulate this question better than I will actually say it, but it seems as though you've sort of cracked a code to a degree. Being able to, as a woman, be someone that is hired for what you do, your voice. How the hell did you do that? How did you manifest this position?
Beats me. All I can say is that I mean, I worked my tail off, and I've done things in like earlier when I was finding my voice and doing all of these short films, you kind of learn, okay, I love doing this. Maybe I'm not so good for that genre. I'll tell you, I don't know. I'm fucking lucky. Sorry for swearing. You probably
no, swear more.
I'm so lucky. And yes, I was ready for it and no one's really lucky. You know, like I was prepared, but I mean, it comes down to like a few early projects where I just, again, like Emma had such generosity of collaboration to just let my freak flag fly in that one, in Shiva Baby. And I think once you see, I think people really resonated with that. And that I think that's how I cracked the code, is that you have one instance where you show what you know, you show yourself, and that one happened to get a lot of visibility. And then you've kind of earned yourself permission to be that way. It set a baseline for kind of experimentation and our artistic license. So it really gave me permission to do more unexpected things with future directors.
Is there a level of, and I don't mean this in any pointed way, I mean this in a celebratory way, give me the most charitable interpretation of what this question, is there a level of gamesmanship, like that you maybe have cultivated or something? Because it's like the ability to rise above the fray, right? There's like talent will get you far, right? And artistic integrity will get you far, but there's got to be, I'm guessing, you know, to be in such a unique position, maybe gamesmanship is not the right word, but some level of strategy.
Wish I could say there was more intention behind it. It's like it's just the kind of music that I'm drawn to and love. And like I've said this a million times in many other ways, but like I'm very, very, very drawn to artists who kind of hone imperfection and but in a very controlled way. And but I also really love classical music, and I really love, like, you know, very organized, well-structured, well-performed music too. I don't just love torturing instruments, but, you know, I think having honestly a bulk of background in folk and jazz, and having like grown up around kind of more colloquial, like, you know, just everyone singing, whether they were good or bad in a space, you know, I've developed an appreciation for a lack of polish that I think, like, an intentional lack of polish that resonates with a lot of these stories. Not to say that that's my only technique, because She's in Charge Now doesn't have a lack of polish, right? Sure. But it's, yeah, I mean, it's so tough. I think, and I know a lot of composers who like feel like what they're being asked to do isn't what they want to do. And I think in that regards, I mean, that's part of why I wrote my first string album, was like, there was a scenario in which I wasn't going to be able to release music for something. And I was like, fuck it, I'm going to write it then. And I'm going to have something that I can publish myself, or, you know, that I can release myself. And, I think if there's someone who continues to be getting hired for one thing and they really want to show that they can do something else, then invest in yourself, record it. It may not go anywhere, but it's an investment in your, you know, in your development. And then you can actually point to that as in your repertoire. Because you can't just say, you can't, just like with Sanctuary, like I couldn't have shown that in any other way but to just do it and hope that they like it.
So it's almost as though it's not gamesmanship in terms of like industry, 5-year plan, yada yada. It's more just invest in yourself and stay true to your voice. That is, yeah, that's the game.
As trite and, you know, like common that advice is, it works. Like it. And, you know, like it's only in the last 3 years that I, like, the projects have become more high profile, but, you know, like I've been doing this for a long time now, and it's like So, you know, it's not like it happens overnight either, you know, and it just like I had this arsenal of aesthetics that I loved and that I've honed. And it's just like I've finally been able to like they've finally crystallized into commercially viable in many ways.
It's really interesting to hear, though, that you correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like you haven't had to done much creative compromise per se. You seem very open to pivoting. You know, this was my idea. I'm not going to die on that hill. So you haven't found yourself, or maybe in earlier stages, like were you saying no, or were projects coming to you that you ended up doing what you wanted to do, and you were never really asked to do something outside of what you were comfortable of doing?
I mean, I think we're always asked to do that, but I will say, so first of all, I think it's a very harmful stance to come in and think that your music is something to be protected and unchanged at all costs. And this is because I have the privilege of working with really respectful, passionate artists on the other, you know, the directors and producers. And I haven't had, you know, so I say that with that experience in mind. Whereas if I'm protective and guarded and too attached to what I'm doing, that doesn't allow, it just creates, it doesn't, and also like I always pretty much agree with any revisions and notes people ask for. Like, yes, of course, I'll have some disagreements and I'll provide alternatives or whatever, but I think it's just a collaboration, and you have to remember that music is not the most important thing. It's one of many. And like that humility, I think, is really important. Like if you're so worried about, you know, being distanced from your initial creative vision, then this will be a really hard career in many ways. But I haven't been asked to like mimic iconic sounds, you know, like I'm not the composer who has to like give a low budget John Williams sound, you know, and I haven't been asked to do that. And I imagine when you start being asked to do things like that, that's a bit that, of course, that's into the realm of like, you start, you know, you might compromise a bit more if you are being given a template to fit into. So maybe something super minimal versus that beautiful, complex melody that you wrote actually serves the film better, you know, and there's a reason why only some music ends up on soundtracks and some doesn't. Like, you know, there, you don't always add everything you write for something on a soundtrack. And I think soundtracks always debut the large, you know, the greatest, like the most musical moments of a series or of a film. But there is like a lot of the job is the connective tissue and the like the kind of get out of the way but set the right tone work. That's just as important, but not as like musically self-sufficient.
I believe you did some interesting work with recording program with the Alliance for Women. God damn it.
AWSC.
Recording work with the AWSC. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So along with my dear friend, Catherine Joy, you know, we were both noticing it's a mission in both of our lives. And also we noticed that this is one of the hardest things to do is produce music. So to be the one on, you know, in the booth, making the decisions about the music as it's being recorded. We wanted to give inexperienced composers, up and coming composers, diverse composers, an opportunity to have a recording session with a large string orchestra. Many of which we chose people that did not have an extensive recording background. We wanted to give them the opportunity to be the boss at a recording session for music that then they could use for anything. And oftentimes, you know, it took me years to get in front of an orchestra. And so it's really hard to like finally build up the funds and have the right project to want to hire an orchestra. And so we wanted to give that opportunity. This was just the first round. that it's going to be orchestra. It'll be different ensembles later on, but teaching different skills. But basically, it's about having we paired each participant up with a mentor. I was a mentor. Catherine was a mentor. And we did 4 or 5 sessions on, so we were recorded with a string orchestra this time. So it's, you know, writing for string orchestras. What about this ensemble is noteworthy, and what, you know, what are different techniques and examples about writing for this ensemble? Another session was like production etiquette, like how, when you hear something out of tune, or you hear something out of rhythm, or you hear, or you want to make a certain note, you know, like how do you continue to elevate morale in the room and make everyone really want to play your music, rather than, you know, communication is so key. The way you give a note really influences how someone treats you, thinks of you, wants to play your music. You know, it's really important to not just be like a, like, no, that wasn't right, you know, scenario. Like, you really have to be a collaborator as a producer as well, and also be open to different interpretations of your music than you thought, you know? And so that's what live musicians bring to it. Is there yet another collaborator that is, you know, like, will make your music better? So teaching those skills, then teaching like music prep, how parts should look, how scores should look. And now currently they're in their mixing phase. So they're working with a mixer, Brian Taylor, that Catherine and I have worked with a lot. And then we're going to be showcasing all of their recordings, you know, when they're ready. But it was basically, you know, there are not a lot of women and non-binary film composers. And one of the most powerful positions you can be in is in front of the producer in a booth. And putting women and non-binary composers in power is how to create more of an inclination to hire us, and just more visibility in general. And it's just the confidence you get of being able to produce a session is invaluable in terms of moving forward. So we'll do another round. We had very generous donations and fundraising, and that's how we were able to have it happen. But yeah, these 7 participants will have a full string orchestra on their pieces.
That's amazing. That's incredible.
It's been really fun.
That is a really meaningful gift
to give. Yeah, to it's something we all wish we had. And like, it, you know, it takes a long time to like get confident in a recording situation. And so it's like, we're happy to spread the wealth on this. And another committee that I'm on is the mentorship committee with Steph Economou and Nami Melumad and Ronit Kirchman. They started it. And now I'm on the committee. And they pair up, they also select composers to then be paired up with like A-list mentors.
If you could have one thing drop out of the sky, your wish is granted, Genie grants you a wish, is there something that comes to mind?
A gift to the women film composers community? Is that what you mean?
Sure. Just across the board. Like, or if there was some sort of institutional change, like would be the thing? What is the thing?
Yeah. Frankly, while there has been a lot of change and visibility and like good moves in terms of diversity initiatives, you know, women and non-binary composers are still like teeny tiny fraction of composers, and they clearly are not representative of the composer community. However, it's not just about giving opportunities to those people, but it's also creating, it's also, you know, nipping it in the bud further upstream, which is like music education, you know, like making sure that this is a viable, like known as a viable career path to more people. You know, it's like making sure that there aren't these socioeconomic and racial inhibitors at every step of the way that prevent certain people from pursuing music in general. And I can't start that upstream, but just to make sure that that everyone is given the resources they need to succeed, and that is not the case. And then my other wish is that studios, directors, producers, again, look like, do not give the same five, six, seven composers the same work, but to really foster new voices. And I'm so grateful, like with, especially with my show On a Small Light, a period piece about Anne Frank, you know, they could have chosen to go with someone with more of a history and like a longer career, someone who's more decorated, but they really chose to go with, they chose to go with me for my voice and for a new voice. And I think that was so exciting. And I just really hope that more chances are taken on people like that who have clearly proven themselves, but perhaps aren't a household name yet.
Yeah, I think to piggyback on what you're saying, I think that, you know, you doing A Small Light and knocking that out of the park really just helps to put out the image, the optics, literally the optics of, you know, this is what a composer looks like, right? Yeah. Because I struggle with is just, what is the image of a composer? There's only one image that I can really think of is that it's, you know, the powdered wig and the baton and basically Beethoven, right?
Yeah.
Or Mozart, and that's it.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't think of, I don't know, can you conjure another image of like, what is a composer?
Yeah, and also, a composer doesn't have to be someone who goes to get, like, has a master's in music and has, you know, studied gone to have a certain trajectory. Like, what I'm so inspired by is like the, that more and more people are being attracted to this craft with non-traditional backgrounds or with like an artist-driven background or a songwriting background or whatever, but it's like, it's pushing, everyone's influencing everyone else. And I think that makes like bolder choices. So this is not, you know, you don't need to, it's not a headshot of you like looking at written music and, you know, with a baton or like it doesn't have to be that. And oftentimes it's the most non-traditional people that shake our industry up. And, I just think that's really important too, that you don't need to have gone to school for it. You don't need to have a certain pedigree to do it. Someone has to like your music and respond to it. You really can, if you are creating music in whatever form you are, you can do it. If you know someone responds to it.
Beautiful, beautifully said. I'm going to ask you one more question and then some rapid fire questions.
Oh God, I suck at rapid fire, by the way.
Point,
I might have my lawyer extract that. Yeah.
I'll give you approval rights over the final edit. What is it? She's in charge now.
Yeah.
There you go. You're in charge now.
Yeah,
I know this is kind of mean to ask, but briefly, can you talk to me about Judaism and music?
So when researching and kind of getting ready for the palette for A Small Light, I was so struck by the Venn diagram between like folk, jazz, klezmer, classical, and how there are so many techniques, modes, ensembles, rhythm, like odd rhythms. There's so many similarities between all of these kinds of music. And I think like, especially the story that I just did, like Amsterdam was such a melting pot in terms of, refugees who were there from many places and how that influences music when people move. There are certain modes, there are certain musical tendencies within Jewish music, but there's also an enormous amount of influences and very similar aesthetics in many different, you know, seemingly disparate genres. But I will say all of the temple services I've been to have been like 90% music. And music has been a way to, like, it's just been infused with so many, it's very spiritual for my family, it's enjoyable, it's recreational, like it's very cultural. I've appreciated that more as an adult too, when I do like go see my father sing, how wonderful it is that so much of that service and is embedded in music.
Can you do me the honor of sending me a playlist of the best Jewish cuts? Because I, having grown up with that music as well,
yeah,
I was, there were like two or three bangers, and then the rest of it, I was kind of like,
So I will have to say, and I'm going to credit my husband for this, Jacques Boudreau, he made a playlist for one of, we were having a Hanukkah party with my dad, and he made this most epic playlist of like not the traditional Hanukkah songs and not the traditional, you know, the Hava Nagila, the, you know, like, yes, there are like two or three that everyone knows, but there are so many wonderful interpretations. And so this one definitely rivals the Christmas list. Like it's like 3 or 4 hours long. But I will say that
Jews write all those Christmas songs.
Exactly. I mean, so it's very hard, like what I have a hard time drawing the line between, does, you know, what would actually define something as Jewish. But I'll send you that playlist. But I will say also, like for A Small Light, which was, you know, it is a Jewish story, but it's also a Dutch story. She wasn't Jewish. She was Christian. I think she was Christian. Meep, who helped them hide. The music was meant to be an amalgam of all of those. And like, I drew from everything from like, definitely klezmer aesthetics, but Benny Goodman, like Tom Waits, Andrew Bird, the Squirrel Nut Zippers.
They're Jewish?
Philip Glass. What?
I didn't know the Squirrel Nut Zippers are.
No. I don't. No. But I just mean, maybe some of them are. I have no idea. There are so many different influences that that color music. So,
do you speak Hebrew?
I was bat mitzvah. I read it when I was 13. Yeah. I learned it phonetically. No, I don't. Do you?
Kaha kaha, a little bit. I think I could like get myself out of a pickle, maybe. So I'm conscious of our time. So I'm going to ask you a couple rapid fire questions. Top three heroes and or artistic influences that come to mind in this moment.
Yeah. Ravel, Johnny Greenwood, Ennio Morricone.
Cool. This is a thought experiment. I'm not religious. We were talking about Judaism. I don't think there's heaven in Judaism. So you get in front of God in heaven or hell or purgatory, it could be wherever. And you're asked for a musical offering. Mm-hmm. What do you do?
As in terms of a performance?
Could be. Your call.
I should have said Arvo Pärt for one of my top people. I would offer them Summa performed in a large string orchestra by Arvo Pärt.
Perfect. Do you have a dream project or collaborators?
This is so lame. I've been so happy with who I've worked with already. Like it's just the project. I'm meeting my heroes.
Amazing. Practical advice for upcoming musicians.
Put in the work. Just do it. You have to do it for a while. You can't expect immediate results, but the best advice I got when I was earlier in my career is that the only people who don't make it are the ones who quit. So it's a matter of just believing in yourself, investing yourself, have a part-time job, babysit, bartend, do whatever, make money, record your music, make it more and more of a priority. You know, it's a long trajectory, but it'll happen if you keep at it.
Thank you so much, Ariel, for your time. I love speaking with you, listening to your music. You are truly an inspiration.
Thank you so much. So good to see you.